BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the foreign affairs specialist Fiona Hill. Her life brings together 3 countries: Britain, where she was born, Russia, which she has made her life's work, and the United States, where she lives and has advised Presidents George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump, and was an expert witness at the latter's first impeachment. She grew up in the northeast of England in the 1970s and early 80s and witnessed the region's painful deindustrialisation firsthand. Her father, a former coal miner, told her, "There's nothing for you here, pet." She couldn't take up the scholarship she won to the local private school because her family couldn't afford the uniform and books, but she forged a path to university to study Russian language and history. She spent the subsequent decades charting Russia's transition from decaying industrial giant to a new kind of 21st century superpower and chronicled the stories of those who, like her own community, had been left behind. She moved to Washington, D.C. and became an American citizen. There, she is an authority on Russia's new power base built on energy and information and the man who controls it, Vladimir Putin. Since the invasion of Ukraine, she's answered dozens of media invitations to share her expertise. She says people like me who move literally from the coal house to the White House tend to be the exception that proves the rule of how difficult it is to get ahead, even in the best of times. Yet everyone should have the same and equal opportunity for social mobility, whether they're born in coal country or in the capital city. Fiona Hill, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, Fiona, as far back as 2007, you were warning the West about Vladimir Putin's intentions, but the people in power didn't seem to be listening to you. As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, how do you deal with that on a personal level?
Well, it's quite heavy weight, to be honest. And part of, you know, the issue that I've always experienced in these jobs, you mentioned back in 2007 when I was the National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia under President George W. Bush, is you couldn't say to the president, look, on, say, June the 2nd of 2008, X is going to happen in this kind of way. This is how it's going to unfold. And instead, you're basically laying out there trends and saying, look, we can see here that Vladimir Putin and the people around him have a specific perspective. We can see that they are focused on this set of issues. These larger trends are underway. And all of this comes together, producing a kind of likely effect that something not particularly pleasant is going to happen.
When you came to public attention during Donald Trump's impeachment, people started talking about your accent, Fiona. Do you think it held you back when you were starting out?
It certainly did in the UK context. I mean, the irony is when I moved to the United States, it was quite different. And just recently, my old boss, Donald Trump, had this quote about me basically saying she'd be nothing without that accent.
You're a deep state stiff with a nice accent.
Yeah, which is really, you know, very funny because, of course, in the UK context, the connotations of the Northeast accent were always working class. And then that, as I, you know, kind of moved on and progressed onto going to university and going to interviews, I immediately had people wincing with the accent. I had many suggestions that I should go to elocution lessons. And I immediately started, you know, I used to joke with my dad, he'd have his telephone voice on. And I'd listen carefully that my dad, when he picked up the telephone, would be another person. And so I thought adapting dad's telephone voice, you know, might work a bit, but it always just sounded a little bit silly. Mm-hmm. And that kind of feeling that, you know, the accent was going to follow you around and not wanting to lose it either, because it's part of you.
Fiona, we've got a lot to dig into today. And of course, your discs as well. So let's get started, shall we, with your first. What's your first selection to take to the island today?
Message in a Bottle from the album Requête de Bonk was the first actual LP back in the day that I bought with my own money. It was my birthday money for turning 15, and my sister and I played it on our little record player in our bedroom over and over again until my dad actually asked us to stop. And we used to sit around holding hairbrushes as one did, you know, singing towards the window, you know, just a castaway lost at sea, because we kind of felt like that, you know, as teens. It's kind of a teenage anthem. I'll send an SOS to the world. I'll send an SOS to the world. I hope that someone gets mine. I hope that someone gets mine. I hope that someone gets my message in a bottle, yeah. Message in a bottle, yeah.
The Police and Message in a Bottle. So Fiona Hill, let's go back to the beginning then. You were born in Bishop Auckland, County Durham in 1965, and your father Alfred worked as a hospital porter for most of his life, but before that he had been a miner and he was from a mining family, so that was very much his identity, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, my dad always said, once a miner, always a miner, and he had left school at 14 to become a coal miner. And this kind of shaped the psyche around as well. My father was always talking about, you know, how difficult mining was. And I kept wondering in some respects then why he romanticised it. But it was the camaraderie, it was the community and the sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself. And my father would just find the humour in everything. You know, for one rock fall that my dad had been in, they'd all had to crawl through the area in which basically the men and the pit ponies all went to the toilet, you know, basically, just to put it politely.
Yeah.
And my dad said, it's just the worst thing ever. And he said, I was really lucky that I wasn't like the other men. They all had these big moustaches and beards. And they all came out and they'd had to, you know, get their faces all of in it. And he said, I said to them afterwards, I kept telling you to shave off that moustache and that beard, you know. I told you to get yourselves into trouble at some point. And he would act it out. So you had the physical comedy aspect of it as well. And we'd all just like fall about laughing. And then really, when you thought about it, this wasn't especially funny.
I want to ask about your mum as well, June. She was a midwife. What was she like?
She was. Now, for her, she loved her job. She is one of that first crop of National Health Service midwives that we have a whole television series about. She delivered hundreds of babies all over the place.
Didn't you go with her once to deliver a baby?
Down the street, one of my neighbours went into labour and they weren't going to be able to get the hospital in time, and she dragged me over with her. And, yeah, that really put me off having children. I think, you know, if anybody ever wants to, you know, kind of helping your mother deliver a baby at age 14, I was just horrified by the whole process.
I think we'd better hear disc number two, Fiona. What's it going to be?
Well, disc number two is something that really reminds me of my dad. It's Ella Fitzgerald, It's Only a Paper Moon. My dad knew all of the words and would sing along to it. And he had a very nice baritone. And he would lead all of us in a chorus. And it's just a great song because it's about the artificiality of life unless somebody believes in you and loves you. And that's, you know, I felt a lot of love from my parents.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
It's Only a Paper Moon, Ella Fitzgerald. So Fiona Hill, you were a bright kid and your parents were very keen to help you learn. How did they encourage you to do that?
They invested in an entire set of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. I would spend an inordinate amount of time, this is rather sad, sitting on the stairs, which was the only kind of quiet place in the house, a very small house, reading the Encyclopaedia Britannica and looking things up.
And this, so the complete set's huge. How
enormous.
Did you accommodate it in your little house?
My dad had a friend make some shelves for us and they kind of blocked everything. You couldn't get into the bathroom because the shelves stuck out through the bathroom door. And most of my knowledge came from the Encyclopaedia Britannica.
Now, your dad didn't earn much as a hospital porter, so your mum was the family breadwinner, but she had to give up work when you and your sister were born, which meant less money coming in. Your parents couldn't afford a TV and I think that caused you some problems at school, I think.
It did early on, yeah. While I was at elementary school, it was the royal wedding between Princess Anne and Mark Phillips. And we were assigned to write about the wedding. But we had to write about what we saw. Mm-hmm. And my mum complained to the school and said, well, we don't have a television. It's actually several people in the school didn't have a television. So how were we going to do that? And they said, well, then I suppose you'll fail the assignment. And I mean, I was quite young, but I thought, I don't want to fail the assignment. This isn't fair. So I thought, well, what can I do? And then the neighbours across the way, they had a colour television. And so I took my dad's radio. I stood in this patch of grass and I was kind of peering in, listening to the radio and watching it. And then
until they
spotted me. But I'd already got a lot of way into it. They kind of closed the curtains because I don't think they realised it was me. Could you see somebody looking over into the window? So I ran in and kind of wrote down quickly everything that I had remembered.
You passed Year 11 Plus in 1976. You came first in the class and you were offered a place at the local private school, but you just weren't able to take it up. Why not?
Well, because my mum and dad just couldn't afford all the extras and they weren't included. I mean, it was actually, you know, a generous scholarship. But, you know, sometimes it's that opportunity. You can't actually take the opportunity that comes along. And that
it's
was also
a
very
early
lesson. Yeah, because it was a uniform that was... You know, if you played sports, it was tennis rackets. There was also the bus fare, because this wasn't, you know, the local comprehensive school.
They did want you to get on, though, your parents. They were very keen for that to happen. How did they kind of support you to find a way forward on your own? That was different to that.
Well, it's not just them. It's also County Durham. County Durham maintained through all of this its cultural budget and its educational budget. There were free school trips. There were school exchanges. You could go to museums. And I got all kinds of things because my parents signed me up.
It's time for some more music, Fiona. Your third choice today. What have you gone for?
Well, I've gone for the Specials' Ghost Town, which, you know, for me, they were a really interesting group. They were all together making this fusion music. I love Specials and all the kind of like the ska and the kind of two-tone music that came out of this. At the same time, this was a song that really summed up what it was like living in a northern town in the 1980s when everything was being shut down.
This town is coming like a ghost town. All the clubs have been closed down. This place is coming like a ghost town.
Ghost Town by the Specials. So, Fiona Hill, you took your A-levels at the local comp. Why did you decide to study Russian for your degree?
For anybody who's listening who's in their 50s and above, they might remember 1983. This was the war scare, basically over the stationing of new nuclear missiles in Europe. And it's Europe's version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I thought, well, I can't just kind of sit around here and do nothing. I should try to do something practical. I thought maybe I'll just go and study Russian, which seemed a little preposterous, actually. But one of my father's cousins, who we called Uncle Charlie Crabtree, he'd fought in World War II. He'd been in the Merchant Marine during the convoys of taking supplies to the Soviet Union when they were allies in World War II. And he couldn't understand it. He said, how did we go from basically being wartime allies to the Soviets wanting to bloody well blow us up? And he said to my dad, your Fiona's good at languages. She should go and learn Russian and just figure that out. And my dad came home and said, I saw Uncle Charlie. He thought he should go study Russian. I thought, yeah, I should.
You had an interview at Oxford. How did it go?
Terribly. I mean, first of all, my mum made me a dress for the, which was a bit disastrous. It was kind of heraldic pattern and I looked like I
so
was
crests.
Wearing crests. I looked like I was wearing wallpaper. And there were some girls already waiting on the kind of the wooden bench outside of the Oxford Don's office that was going to do the interview. And one of them I'd met when I was 13 and I was in an exchange to Germany. And she said, Fiona Hill, what are you doing here? And I thought, yeah, what am I doing here? And then, you know, I started to talk to her, trying to kind of, you know, smooth things over. And how are you? You know, how are things? And the other two girls start wincing and then snickering at my accent. And then my name was called and I was so flustered. I wasn't really kind of paying much attention. And one of the girls had a leg stuck out. Now, I don't know whether it had been stuck out. I kind of think she'd stuck it out. But, you know, I was not paying attention sufficiently in any case because I was just sort of thinking, oh, my God, nightmare. I'm so embarrassed. And they're looking up and down at my heraldic dress and I feel really silly and out of place. And I step up and I fall over the other girl's leg into the door, smash my nose. My nose starts bleeding and I open the door and the Oxford Don professor lecturer looked at me and said, oh, dear, have you had an accident?
Oh, Fiona, let's hear your fourth choice. What have you gone for and why?
We're going to hear Iggy Pop, The Passenger. It's a song about riding around in a car. And nobody in my family had a car. When I first get to America, there's cars everywhere. And I also didn't think that I was going to stay in America for a long period of time. I thought I'd have this master's degree. I'd leave, I'd come back and do something in the United Kingdom. So I should try to see as much of America as I possibly could. So I befriended lots of people with cars so I could be a passenger, have my fares glued to the window. And I also took a lot of train trips and bus trips on Greyhound buses. You know, the passenger, you know, always kind of riding through and looking out the window.
I am a passenger.
The Passenger, Iggy Pop. So Fiona Hill, you read Russian and History at St Andrews University, and then you got a grant to take Soviet Studies at Harvard. You decided to stay in the States, where you worked for a think tank called the Brookings Institution and later moved into intelligence. That led to you sitting next to Vladimir Putin at an official dinner. How did that happen?
At the time, I was actually working for the US government. I was the National Intelligence Officer. I sat next to him and I thought, why am I seated next to him? Is this because they think I'm M, like Judi Dench? I was kind of channeling in all of my other inward fantasies. And then I thought, well, am I the least likely person to stab him with a fork in the thigh? It turned out nothing of the sort. I was told later by the person sitting the other side of him, who was one of his press people, woman of a similar sort of age, that it was because I was a nondescript woman. Neither too old nor too young, you're not fancily dressed, you've got no cleavage, you're just kind of there. I was like tableware.
So to allow him to shine.
Exactly, because he said nobody's going to look at you and think, who are you? But if a man's sitting next to him, they'll all think, who's that man? Why is he next to Putin? And people will be distracted and you were just there.
How closely were you observing him and
what
did you notice?
I would just reached out my hand ever so slightly, I would have touched him. So I'd take in the suit, you know, the finely tailored suit, you know, the way that a little vein pulses on the left-hand side of his face, the way that, you know, I noticed right away that he was actually, you know, like the rest of us, he really could have done with glasses because he had these giant cards. I mean, I could read them all of his cards about, you know, telling him who was who and what he should say and things like this. And I noticed he didn't eat or drink anything. I watched the watch on his wrist, very expensive. And I could almost, now this sounds really bizarre, but I could smell that he was freshly laundered. He wasn't wearing cologne, but it's like it was almost like he'd stepped out of some sort of special preparatory bath or something into the moment. He was just all in command of himself, you know, projecting this image. And I thought, wow, look at this. I mean, he's just, all of this is staged. Every little element of his is staged. This is a performance.
Did you talk to him?
Well, not really, no. He's not much of a conversationalist. And he barely gave me a glance. But at the end of it, he stood up and he said, all the best. I said, oh, thank you very much. Same to you, President Putin. Shook my hand.
Fiona, during your time at Brookings, you researched the war in Chechnya and you spent time then with Chechen separatists. Some of your colleagues warned you that that could be very dangerous and they were proved right. What ended up happening?
Basically, I was having a conversation with a bunch of Chechens, and one of them was saying to me, "No, you're asking too many questions here. You need to be careful." And, you know, another one said to me, "Look, Fiona, we like you. You're a nice girl, but you should not be going there." And, you know, about 5-10 minutes later, you know, I was handed a drink because I just asked if I could have, you know, something to drink. It wasn't alcohol or anything. I took the drink and I felt immediately really very strange. And as I stood up, I passed out. And somebody else who was kind of with the group, not with them, you know, took me, you know, kind of quickly back to my hotel room, and I was violently ill. And they called someone from the medical system and they immediately said, you've been poisoned. But well, it wasn't kind of clear what it was.
Or who had done it.
Or who had done it. It was a warning. And I, you know, definitely took it to heart afterwards.
Fiona, it's time for your fifth selection today. What have you gone for and why are we going to hear this?
Well, I've picked basically a Russian group, Nauters Pompilius, and the song is Goodbye America, sometimes also known as The Last Letter. This was the anthem of my year abroad studying when I was at St Andrews in Moscow in 1987-88. It charts the trajectory of US-Russian relations from the period of hope in 1988 when I got there to just before the period where we are now, where here we are with a confrontation with Russia. And now Nauters Pompilius, for most Russians, they know this song.
Goodbye, America. Прощай навсегда.
Nautilus Pompilius and Goodbye America. So, Fiona Hill, in 2017, you joined the National Security Council as an advisor on Europe and Russia under President Trump. Why did you take the job?
It was from people I'd worked with before when I'd been in the intelligence community. And, you know, they thought that given all the work that I'd done on Putin, my reputation already then for blunt speaking and for being able to explain things in a kind of an approachable way, that I could maybe sit down with Trump and explain to him the perils of Putin. And I thought, well, I should. Mm-hmm. Again, spirit of public service, try to see what I could do to push back with others. I mean, this was a kind of a mission with other people to push back against what the Russians had done, make sure they couldn't do it again. And I really was naive, honestly, about the domestic politics in the US, because I thought that everybody would understand the national security implications of this. Not that we would actually be in this crazy period in American politics in where Russia became part of the domestic politics, not as a national security actor or a security threat, but, you know, part of the whole fabric of this partisan infighting and of politics itself.
Despite your experience and being an authority on your subject, President Trump didn't know who you were. At one stage, he thought you were a secretary. How did that end up happening?
Well, that's right. Look, one of the jobs of the senior director for the National Security Council on whatever subject it is to take notes in high-level meetings with the president and the national security advisor. I mean, you do get to be the note taker. And I was, you know, sitting there taking notes for a phone call with Putin. And I was listening very carefully to what Putin was saying. And I suddenly realised that, in fact, Trump was looking at me and wanting me to basically edit and rewrite the press statement from the meeting. And I did not react particularly well. I kind of looked up, deer in the headlights look. Oh, my God, he's talking to me, because he says to me, "Are you listening, darling? Hey, darling, I'm talking to you," kind of thing. And I thought, darling? Oh, God, that can only be me.
It sounds like an incredibly stressful and unpredictable working environment. How did you cope with that?
I was really glad I'd read Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass, because that I just felt that was it. I was at the court of, you know, the Red Queen or the Mad Hatter's Tea Party every single day. I mean, we couldn't really talk about it outside because we were actually trying to make sure that things did not go off the rails. I mean, I was really kind of shocked, honestly, about how narcissistic he was. I mean, yes, we've all read about it, but to actually experience it, he's no different in public and private. It wasn't about America first. His only ideology was self-idolatry. This was a man who didn't know any history. And it was all just, everything was all defined about things that he could define that related to himself. And as a result of that, all the things that he actually could have done that could have been positive, he didn't have the discipline to follow them through. And we were just kind of trying to go around to kind of mitigate the damage.
Fiona, we've got to make some time for the music. It's your sixth choice today. What's it going to be and why are you taking this to the island with you?
So this is Imagine Dragons, a great, you know, contemporary American band. And the song is On Top of the World. And during the time when I was working for the Trump administration, one of my few diversions was to actually go out to concerts or, you know, kind of go home and listen to music and try to forget about everything. And I had a really great friend, Shane Green, who very sadly passed away of cancer on the day of lockdown. But he bonded with me and my husband over all kinds of music. And in the middle of kind of all of this craziness of Trump, we all decided to go to a concert, you know, way out of town, Imagine Dragons. And of course, I couldn't get out of the White House. I'm in time and they're all waiting for me outside and trying to pick me up. And I'm there in my suit. I didn't get a chance to change. And then we kind of drive down to Virginia and we kind of get out in this open air concert during the summer. And I'm wearing a suit, carrying my little bag and my badge from the White House. I'm trying to stick in my bag and everybody's in casual clothes on blankets listening to Imagine Dragons. But it was one of the best days. I'm on top of the world.
Tried to cut these corners, tried to take the easy way. I kept on falling.
Imagine Dragons and On Top of the World. So Fiona Hill, you left the White House in the summer of 2019, and that November you testified against President Trump during his first impeachment. Now, as a woman, you knew that it mattered not just what you said, but also how you presented yourself when you came to testify. How did you prepare?
Well, first of all, I also needed a lawyer. And the law firm took on or they had working with them, a PR consultant, a woman named Molly Levinson, who was just an expert in all of these kinds of events as well, because I hadn't even thought about the fact that millions of people would be watching this live. But Molly was basically saying, well, we've got to figure out, first of all, what you're going to wear. And I said, why? Why is that the case? Because as a woman, you're going to be really scrutinised. And she said, you're going to end up in the style section of the Washington Post. I said, oh, come on. She was absolutely right. And so she actually, before we even got to going through all of the way that questions were going to be answered, she went with me through my wardrobe to get things that would be appropriate for the event, and they arranged for makeup and hair, because she said you can't be distracting. You know, you've got to basically ground yourself. It's going to be really cold in these rooms. You've got to be, you know, appropriate dressed so your teeth don't chatter. Press your balls of your feet into the floor so you're not making unnecessary movements.
Kept cool for the judges in their
robes. Yeah, but all the robes and extra layers of clothing. And she said you could freeze. And in fact, the other witness, David Holmes, who was from the embassy in Kiev, who was the other witness with me, we did end up in the style section of the Washington Post. People talking about our reassuringly dull clothes. You know, we look the part. And people were not, apart from my accent and my opening testimony, people were very much focused on what I was saying, the answers to all of the questions, and not so much on, oh my God, look at that woman. What does she look like? Or what's she wearing?
That opening statement, your testimony, your story became part of a historic moment. And, you know, unexpectedly, for the first time in your professional life, you were the story. How did you adjust to that level and that type of attention?
Well, it wasn't until really the next day, because I was just shattered after the whole experience when I went home. I had a friend, you know, kind of drove around with a box of Epsom salt so I could go and have a bath and a chicken dinner. And we just recently purchased a dog, you know, it was kind of like a little therapy animal. And I kind of petted the dog. And the next morning I got up and I was like, oh, my God, there was all these phone calls, there was texts and messages. And I was over the front page of every imaginable newspaper. And I just thought, uh-oh, what just happened? Basically, I'd go out into the street and just all my neighbours appeared. I got flowers from all of my neighbours. I thought, what's this about? I just told the truth. And articles being written about the accent and...
It wasn't all positive, unfortunately.
No, it was not. No. There was a lot of death threats as well.
How did you explain it to your daughter? She was 12, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of times where people called at home and she heard the messages. So, are they going to come and get us? And I said, no, they're not. They're cowards. For a while, I taped up the letterbox because it was, you know, people were getting pipe bombs and packets of powder and things like that. And then, look, I mean, I grew up in the northeast of England. I'm not that easily intimidated. And I just decided, OK, right, I'll just have to just be very vigilant and just ignore all of this. But I'm not going to let these people intimidate me, because this is how we end up with tyranny, with the destruction of our democracy, because a lot of people are far too scared to stand up and to speak out.
It's time for your next disc, Fiona. Number 7, what are we going to hear and why?
Well, number 7 is by another lad from the northeast of England, Sam Fender, and Hypersonic Missiles. And I came across this by accident, actually, because I, you know, of course, hypersonic missiles have been the kind of last thing that we were talking about in the context of arms control with Putin and Trump. And At one point, I decided to Google hypersonic missiles just to kind of see if other people were picking up on it. And I get Sam Fender's song, Hypersonic Missiles.
Takes you straight to North Shields.
Exactly. And I'm watching the video and I'm like, oh, my God, this is the 1980s. He's channeling my angst of when I was a kid. It's a really good song.
Sam Fender and Hypersonic Missiles. So, Fiona Hill, as we know now, President Trump was acquitted of the impeachment charges. You are now back at the think tank, the Brookings Institution. How do you look back at your time in the crucible of American politics? And did you learn anything that you didn't already know about yourself?
It wasn't a great experience in many sects. And I often had to just really pull myself together and say, come on, Fiona, get on with it. What would your granddad say? Or what would your grandma say? Or, you know, what would they say back home in Bishop Auckland? Just, you know, get over yourself. Get on with this. You know, just keep on going and remember who you are, where you're from and what you're here to do. that's what I've learned about myself, actually, in a way, that I can do things. You know, when I was a little kid, I thought, how did people do all of these things? How could I, as a little kid, you know, sitting there on the stairs with Encyclopedia Britannica, make something happen? And I've realised that everybody can make something happen, especially if you work with others.
Your mother's still in the Northeast. You're not long back from visiting her. I wonder how it feels to go back home to Bishop Auckland.
It still felt like home, even though, you know, I'm cleaning up my mum's house and my mum's had to move into a care home. There's still, you know, the people I went to school with. I know that place still like the back of my hand, and I want good things to happen. I want the good things to happen for the UK, you know, at large. This is, you know, also, you know, a great country, and there should be something for people everywhere.
Well, Fiona, you're going to leave the UK behind and Russia and America because I'm about to cast you away to a desert island. That's what's coming next for you. We've already heard that you're a survivor and a pretty good traveller. How do you think you'll get on building a life for yourself out there? Have you got any fears about it?
Well, I always think that every day when you kind of get up is a new day and all kinds of things are possible.
Well, one more song before we send you there. What's your last piece of music going to be today?
Well, this song fits in with this. This was the anthem of my, you know, whole college years. And it's Thither, Matt Johnson, This Is The Day. And I think it's a very optimistic, you know, song, because every day I would get up and say, well, this is the day. Maybe this is it. This will be the day that all these kinds of things happen.
You pull back your hands and the sun burns into your eyes. You watch a plane flying across the blue sky.
Thither and This Is The Day. So Fiona Hill, it's time. I'm going to send you away to your desert island. I'll be giving you the books, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare and one other of your choice. What would you like?
Well, you know, it was a toss-up between the entire Encyclopaedia Britannica. I could build a raft out of that. Or Alice in Wonderland, and I think I'll go with Alice in Wonderland.
Why in particular?
It's one of those classics of childhood and a fantastic allegory for all kinds of things that we have to deal with in life.
You can also have a luxury item. What would you fancy?
Well, this is a bit of a strange luxury item, but it's crystallised ginger.
Oh.
I actually have ginger chews that I carry around in my bag. It always reminds me of my grandma. My grandma Vi, who was the most resourceful person that I ever knew, but she also had one of those voluminous, great big white handbags with things in it. And she used to have mint imperials in a tin and a little bag of crystallised ginger. And I always used to go into her bag to look for something. Because you know, all kinds of things were in there, raincoats, umbrellas. It was like a kind of Mary Poppins bag. I could get lost in it. And I would always sneak some of her crystallised ginger and think, oh, that was strong. And then I kind of then rubbing the little bits of the crystallised sugar around my tongue. And now I'm addicted to it. And I just think I would have to have that on the desert island.
Oh, absolutely. An inexhaustible supply is yours. And finally, which track of the eight that you've shared with us today would you rush to save from the waves?
Well, it was really a toss-up between Ella Fitzgerald, It's Only a Paper Moon, because that would give me great memories of my dad, or Thither, This Is The Day. But I think, you know, as I'd be cast away on a desert island, and every day could be the day that, you know, somebody might come along or something very interesting would come along, I think it would be Thither, This Is The Day.
Fiona Hill, thank you very much for letting us hear your desert island discs.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Fiona. We'll leave her to her crystallised ginger and happy memories of her grandma's handbag. We've cast away other governmental advisers, including Dame Louise Casey and Samantha Power. And if you fancy listening to Fiona's fellow Northeasterner, Bob Mortimer, he's in our archive too. You can find these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Sarah Hockley, the assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paul McGinley. Next time, my guest will be the presenter and actor Bradley Walsh. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, Desert Island Disc listeners. I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and in my podcast, Just One Thing, I'm investigating some quick, simple, and surprising ways to improve your health and life. From eating some dark chocolate, That was really good. To improve your heart. To playing video games. To enhance your brain power.
Oh, dear. I'd be slaughtered, aren't I?
Or singing your favourite songs to bolster your immune system. So, to benefit your brain and body in ways you might not expect, here's just one thing you can do right now. Subscribe to the podcast on BBC Sounds.